David Miller was a clerk who lived in the dark, spent 8 hours a day in a tomb.
We had all drifted away from the influence of the church at that stage. So, you know, that wouldn't have affected us. We were going our own way anyway. We were, you know, I mean, we were following what was going on in London.
'60s Ireland, it was pretty repressed. It was very hard to get access to anything that wasn't kind of correct in the as far as the state and the church were concerned, and they were hand in glove. So if you wanted to have a look at, and books were banned. We banned our own writers. And come here to me. You want to get someone, give them a good smack when you hear that.
So we didn't kind of, most of us, gravitate towards, of our group, if you like, and I don't mean the group in terms of the grannies, but our group of friends, we tended to go to places where we were listening to different kind of music at that stage. And certainly we were a niche mob at that time, you know, with our special mod type attire and our listening tastes being played on record player rather than on by a band on stage.
My own father used to look at me. I had hair done halfway down my back, and like it was, they'd look down at the ground and say, "Oh God, what am I after rearing?" And that was the same for all the lads that hung around with me at the time anyway. And the girls were the same. They'd get their fashion from the magazines, and they'd have mini skirts, and they'd have mod outfits, and you know, we were completely different from the norm in the city.
There was no such thing as the teenager before, let's say, the Beatles, really, or something like that. You were a young adult. If you were dressed, you were dressed as a young man, a version of an adult until you grew into adulthood and then carried on the adult thing. And this was something that they looked at it, as did the English, of course, the English who started it, and they said, hang on, this is a new uniform. We can adapt it and we can use it for ourselves. We can grow our hair. And by the very act of walking down the street dressed as you were means that even though you all know my name, I'm the son of Murphy or whoever, I'm now my own man. I'm my own man to do what I want at the moment.
Help. It's the mid-60s in Ireland. The era of the show bands. Help. You know I need someone. Help. But a small countercultural movement is beginning to emerge. Musical options in Ireland are very limited for teenagers at this time, but radicalised youths across the country are looking for means and outlets to express their different ideological take on the world from that of their parents and the church. Drawing on influences from England and America, as the global rock phenomenon started to spread, a countercultural equivalent began to emerge in Ireland. It spawned an understated period in Irish cultural history, commonly known as the Irish beat scene. There were beat movements from Belfast to Cork, and Limerick was also an important hub of this scene and generated numerous bands, including the pivotal Granny's Intentions, a beat group formed by school friends from Limerick in 1965. Originally fronted by Johnny Doohan and James Chaharan, the band went on to record 4 singles and an album for international label Dhiram. While not as widely lauded as the show bands, these understated achievements of a non-conformist generation who organised themselves around the mod movement and refused to dance at De Valera's crossroads are still having an impact to this day.
Well, it was an interesting time, really, because, you know, when we look at the technology we have today, I mean, I've got my Windows phone switched off, I might add, in my pocket.
Jack Costello, a former bass player with Granny's Intentions.
And the access to everything is just instant. And in those days, actually, we didn't even have a record player at home. Times were tough for most of us. And We used to go out to a friend of mine, Jimmy O'Malley's house in Ballinanty. In fact, he and his brother Martin were conceived under the new stand because their houses were demolished. So it was a tough to build a new stand. So it was a tough time in those days. They had a record player. I had a record. So we'd go out there and we'd play it and we'd listen to all sorts of blues music. And if I remember, the first record I bought in Clancy's, the first single in Clancy's, used to have a record store at that time in O'Connell Street. And they sold lots of other things like fridges and various other things for people that could afford them. And the first one I bought was actually Loving You Is Sweeter Than Ever by the Four Tops. And I had to wait 6 weeks for it to come in. So interesting time, hard to get access to the types of music that some of us were interested in at that time in Limerick, which I guess is sort of the genesis for a band like Granny's starting up, because that's what we did. You know, we did sort of R&B and Tamla Motown and stuff, which frankly no one had heard of virtually in Ireland, with the odd exception. So I guess that's one of the reasons why we were unique.
Well, you had no access really, except listening to Radio Luxembourg, who were broadcasting 208 meters medium wave. That was their signal, and Luxembourg was the only one, because RT were not, they were only doing a small amount every week of a pop program, so you had to just buy records in the record shops. Difficult to get as well, because they were concentrating mostly on country and western and showband singers, and also established Irish tenors and so on, like tenors and sopranos, and their business was mostly there. So
Paddy Brennan, who was a teenager during the 60s and is a founder of the Limerick Rock and Roll Club.
If you went into a record shop in the mid-60s and were following a band, just for instance like Moby Grape or Love from Los Angeles, that you heard on Luxembourg, your chances of being able to get one of those records would be slim, because, you know, they wouldn't order one or two copies. So it was difficult for us to get the actual vinyl records, but we, at least we could listen on Luxembourg. And then with the advent of pirate radio in the 60s, Radio Caroline were broadcasting, and they were in the Irish Sea, which it meant that the signal was picked up mostly, well, the best signal was in the East Coast, where Dublin, but we were able to pick up Radio Caroline and listen to all those English bands and those American West Coast, the Birds, Buffalo Springfield, Jefferson Airplane. Grannies were also listening. Obviously, members of Grannies must have been listening to all this, because songs, the soul music, Motown and Stax, Atlantic, all those songs were being played on Luxembourg and on Caroline. And that's what influenced the bands like the Grannies.
At that time, there wasn't much happening at all in Ireland, musically or fashion-wise.
James Chaharan, an original member of the band Granny's Intentions.
It was just, the lifestyle was get up in the morning, go to work, come home and listen to the radio. That was it. When you talk about music, there was no midweek music any place. Like, you might have a dance in the Royal George Hotel, and then you had the Jetland on the weekend. That wasn't even Friday, it was Saturday and Sunday. So that was it. So, like, if you had interest in music yourself, there was no place to go. There was, like, discos weren't there. There was no discos, as they were known, or hops, they used to call them. They popped up then when, in the mid-60s, you had places like the Hop out in the old Dublin Road, a galvanised building, and there was a guy who used to play records in there. And the youth then started to go to places like that, and you had places popped up in the Shelburne Lawn Tennis Club in Limerick, which was out at the back of the maternity there, and they had a hop of a Saturday night, and they'd be playing music of, like, they were listening to Anne Caroline and Luxembourg. So our type were going to those places rather than going to the ballrooms.
The showband scene was at the height of its popularity in Ireland in the mid-60s, but it wasn't satisfying Irish mods who were looking to seek out international music that was defining their generation, as Paddy Brennan remembers.
Well, when I started going to dances first in the 60s, I think the only outlet really would have been the Stella in Limerick and the Jetland, which was the mid-60s, really, 65, I think the Jetland opened. But I went to see all the showbands back in these places. The showbands were good as well. You can't take it from them. They were very versatile musicians. But they often did arrangements of songs which, you see, a showband had 8 or 9 people in the band. So they weren't going to leave the brass section out of a lot of songs. They wanted to play. So you could have the showband could cover a song by The Who, which would have been popular at the time, and there could be brass in it. To me, that wouldn't be the same. But they had to think of all the rest of the musicians. They couldn't have the musicians standing up for the night, not if they concentrated on the songs as they were recorded. You see, if you're into all the beat or the groups of the 60s from Liverpool and from Birmingham and from London, the showbands weren't covering them the way you wanted them to be covered. They covered them from a musical point of view to include all their members. So that meant that the youth of Limerick and maybe the youth of Ireland wanted to be able to hear the songs as they were played originally on the records, which they were beginning to listen to through pirate radio and through access to a limited amount of vinyl that they were able to get their hands on.
Just because we get around.
Talking about my generation.
Things they do look awful.
Talking about my generation.
I hope I die before I get old.
For the first time in Irish history, a generation gap between the youth of the day and their parents began to emerge. Through fashion and music, Irish teenagers began to shake off the shackles of both state and church and finally started to express themselves. Pete Cummins, a beat musician who later went on to play in Granny's Intentions, was growing up in Dublin during this period.
There was a definite break between the generations in the 60s. I mean, there would have been a lot of resistance from parents to the way teenagers were now behaving, the way they were dressing, the way they expected to stay out late. And whereas before that, it was a much more restrictive society. And it was just like something happened and it couldn't be controlled, you know. The kids were just going to do these things. They were going to do what they wanted to do. And they did, you know. And it was a huge change from the grayer 50s and early 60s, you know. And, you know, either you got on with it or you had a problem with it. It's like any change. When change comes, you know, either you'd go with it or you're in conflict with it. If you don't go with it, you know, you're left behind, you know. Amused or bemused or confused, you know.
The reason we didn't want to go the showband route or anything like that was that we were listening to different music. We were after listening to Luxembourg and Radio Caroline, and the showbands were doing country and western. And it wasn't for us, cowboy hats and singing about I'm going back to my mammy next week if my heart is breaking and all. It just wasn't for us. We were listening to bands like, as I said, the Stones, Beatles, Kinks, Pretty Things, The Who. So that it was exciting. It was new. It was turning our heads to that type of. And again, we were a different generation, like the long hair and the bell bottoms and the Beatle boots, and fashion and music were going hand in hand at that time. And that's the way we it was exciting and it was different, and that's why we were looking for something different. That was our track.
In Limerick, like all over the country, like-minded young people began to hang out together, listening to international beat music and dressing differently to that of their peers. Two such people were James Chaharan and Johnny Doohan.
I remember myself and Johnny Doohan as kids on Wolfland Street. On the corner there, across from Bobby Burns's, there was a big yard before it turned into a school, and a carnival used to come there. The Birds, they were a Dublin family, but they moved to Limerick later on. But they used to run a carnival there. And I remember they had a talent competition, and myself and Doohan went there, and we had bright coloured shirts and that, and pictures of Bill Haley and Little Richard that came in chewing-gum cards at the time, and we had them pinned onto the front of our shirts, and we got up and done Rock Around the Clock, because we had... We'd heard that music on Luxembourg. Like, you could see then that we wanted to do something different. It wasn't the normal country western stuff or the traditional Irish music, which wasn't huge or anywhere big as it is now. Then it was definitely the show I've been saying was rolling the roast then.
Underground musical movement of beat groups was underway in Ireland, providing a much-needed outlet for the music of the 60s youth generation. One such band to form was The Intentions from Limerick City. Singer Johnny Doohan was an original member.
I'd played with a few of the guys. I'd tried to start a few beat groups myself at that time, down in the shed in our house. But a friend of mine then beat me to it, a fella called Ger Toohey. We used to listen to rhythm and blues and blues music together up in his house after school when we were going to Sexton Street. And he started a rhythm and blues band in 1964, and they were practicing up in the Augustinian Hall behind the Augustinian Church up in O'Connell Street, right behind it. And he asked me to come along and see what I thought. Guido De Vita was playing drums. A fellow called Joe Heelan was playing guitar, and Joe Donnell and Jack Costello was on bass, and Ger himself was singing and playing the harmonica. He asked me to jump up and sing a song, and I did. And the minute I did it, they asked me would I join the band. And that was tough for Ger, because eventually poor Ger, he started playing the harmonica then on the side, but eventually he left himself. He had started the band, and he left, and Chahan joined. At that stage, we started off with rhythm and blues, and then we were probably the first band in Ireland to see the advent of soul music and Tamil Motown, and we started dabbling in that. And I think Ger didn't like that too much either. He felt that was going commercial, kind of, you know. But there were bands like the Temptations and the Impressions, and from these kind of names we actually thought up our own name, which was The Intentions. It's had that kind of soul-y sound.
Before joining The Intentions, Chaharan was a member of short-lived Limerick beat group Fifth Edition.
I started off with two lads that I went to school with that I knew that played instruments. Joe Heelan was a rhythm guitar player, and Joe Donnell, who was lead guitar, who later went on to play with East of Eden and Van Morrison and that, and has his own Celtic rock band in Sheffield at the moment. Paul Hanrahan, who played bass, and Eamon Walsh played drums. They were at school with me as well, and they were in the same mindset as myself. And Doohan had started his band, The Intentions. And at that time, when Glyn, that Jackie Glyn guy at the music shop, he used to have talent competitions in the local hall here, the old Crescent Hall, in there on O'Connell Street. And the fifth edition would play, and The Intentions would play. But that two-band thing didn't go on for too long. We, at most, those two groups were lasted 2 or 3 months before we amalgamated into The Intentions as it became.
Jack Costello was a bass player in Limerick at that time.
Well, the reason I started playing bass was there was no bass players, and it was around, really, and we were all kind of trying to play guitars. And in the band I was in, I had two guys who could play the guitar, Willie O'Connor and Joe O'Donnell. So it turned out I became the bass player, and there was a shop up in, I'm just trying to think what street is it, in Cecil Street, or but Peter Dempsey's. Used to sell. Peter was a musician himself, used to play with Bud Clancy, and a great keyboard player, a big tall man, big tall red-faced and red-headed man. And I bought the only bass guitar he had there, a red Egmont. My father bought it for me for £7. I remember that was the price at the time. And he paid 10 shillings or 50p a week out of his wages to buy this bass for me. And then I became a bass player. So I was relatively unique, not unique, but at least in a small group of people. I don't think otherwise I'd have got into any bands, you know, because at that time I wasn't very accomplished. But I had a bass, you know.
Jack eventually went on to join The Intentions.
Elvio Nardone was the bass player with The Intentions, and Elvio, who went on to become a very good friend of later on, his dad actually sponsored, if you like, the original Intentions and bought all their equipment. They owned the Roma Cafe up in William Street, and the original Intentions used to rehearse in the cellar underneath the cafe. And I was asked to join the band, but nobody had told Elvio about it, that he was being replaced by another bass player. So I turned up, kind of not knowing. Joe O'Donnell had also been invited to become the guitar player. And Elvio's nose was put out of joint, understandably, you know, that suddenly I was there, you know, with my cheap guitar. And he had a lovely Fender Jazz, I think, at the time. And so eventually there was a bit of an uproar, and we were evicted from the cellar. And Mr. Nardone closed off his financial support for the band. So it was quite an interesting situation. But Guido's father owned the Savoy Grill down in O'Connell Street, number 3 O'Connell Street. And of course, he immediately, out of brother-in-law rivalry, because they were both married to sisters, I think, the two men, decided to become our financier. So he took us up to Jackie Glenn's and equipped us all. And then we wound up rehearsing for a little while, actually, down in their basement.
The Intentions had their group in place and began to hone their own sound.
Sunday's on the phone again, talking on for hours on end. Just a lot of idle chatter, but it doesn't matter. There's no one at the other end. She talks her troubles into smiles, but no one hears because no one dials. No one hears, so no one tries. It's Sandy who decides. Sandy's always on the winning side. She can't help.
looking at British magazines such as Fabulous and The NME were style blueprints for the youth of the 60s. They wanted to look like the proponents of the music they were listening to on the radio and style themselves on pictures from these magazines. Another pivotal moment in the development of beat group Granny's Intentions was a trip to Dublin to see the Rolling Stones.
The Stones played in the Adelphi in Dublin. We travelled four or five of us in a car. Like, we had heard their records and saw pictures of them in these magazines, and that was a have-to-do type of thing. We went, and they were absolutely, after seeing those, it was a definite effort that we had to get something going ourselves, and it was only copy them. It was something, you know. You could see definitely this was a change in our lives, yeah.
The first time we actually ventured out of Limerick, we already had a band, I think, Ger Tui and myself, and Ger wanted to go and see the Rolling Stones' first concert in Dublin, I think it was. It was in 1965, I think it was. Both six of us went, and my parents allowed me go. I was only 15, and the reason she allowed me to go was because Cha convinced her that he'd look after me, like, you know, and no harm would come to me. When we arrived in Dublin, I remember, it was the advent of the mod era, you know, when a lot of the young fellas were into the, you know, fashionable gear kind of that up to then it was mainly the domain of women, really, you know. So we were very flamboyant, and we used to, when we got to Dublin, we went looking out these male boutiques, and I remember Ger Tuohy, or no, it was a fella that was with us, one of the lads spotted a purple shirt in the window of one of these boutiques with elephant collars, and he wanted to try that on, and I went in, I saw a green and red pair of plaid hipsters. The two of us decided to stick our necks out, and instead of using the B&B money we had, I bought my plaid hipsters with my B&B money, and he bought the elephant collared shirt. And the concert went by in a flash. I remember very little of it, except that the audience down at the front of the theatre for some reason started pulling up the seating and throwing it on the stage. So the Rolling Stones, I forget how many songs they actually played, but there was a lot of other bands on that night as well. That's the way they used to tour in them days. Like, you'd have several different groups on. I remember one was the Ivy League. They had a big hit at the time. So I remember very little of the Rolling Stones concert, other than that the fear that came on us after, because we knew we were going to have to spend the night walking the streets. And what we did actually was we tried to duck into the Cha, and the lads were staying in a place down on the quays, B&B, and we tried to get in there, but the landlady spotted us, and we couldn't get in. The fellow with the purple shirt and myself, I can't even remember his name now. We eventually ended up near Christ Church, and we decided we'd try and sleep in the pavement up there, you know, and we bedded down there. And luckily, an old man came along on a bike, and he suggested that we go around the corner to St. Vincent de Paul's night shelter, and they took us in there. And we spent a night, you know, in with the old men, and I never realised there were so many homeless people. And from that experience, actually, I got one of the first songs I wrote, 100 Miles, it's just called, and Christy Moore actually recorded a version of it.
100 miles from his home, through the lonely city he does roam, till he finds a bed he doesn't own.
The Intentions got their first break playing as a relief band in the dance halls.
We did get to play in the ballrooms because there was an unusual term called, we were known as the relief band, which has all sorts of connotations nowadays. But the relief band was the support band, and we supported a lot of show bands. In other words, we'd open for them, and they'd be playing to the main crowd. And Jetland, which is now, of course, a Dunn's Stores out the Ennis Road, that was the major ballroom at that time. There was a Stella and a few other ones, but that was the big one, you know. And there wasn't even a bar. you know, you didn't have any alcohol in those days. You just they sold orange and Coke or whatever else at the bar, and that was it, and crisps. And across the road there was a big pub. So basically, the vast majority of the show band audience were basically getting well jarred in the pub, while the relief band, us, were playing to probably 18 pioneers with their pioneer pins who weren't drinking alcohol and having their Coca-Cola or their orange, and maybe a few dedicated fans of our own. And that was the beginnings of our existence, if you like, playing to empty ballrooms. And so our experience of the show bands was, when the band was about to come on stage, there was a marauding crowd just forced themselves into the ballroom, and it was suddenly full of inebriated people from the pub. And then the big band struck up, playing all kinds of stuff, country and western charts, and basically everybody got out there and did their thing while we kind of sloped off a little bit.
Well, when you do relief for the show bands, I said the difference of crowds, they didn't know what we were at all. We'd be doing, we'd say Rolling Stones numbers. These people in the audience, 9 out of 10 wouldn't have a clue what we were at. Do you know, they were waiting for Dickie Rocker, Joe Dolan to come on and sing, you know, whatever they were at that stage. They were mostly people who were listening to Radio Éireann. They weren't switching into Radio Luxembourg or Caroline at the time then. They were just two different types of music lovers, you know.
The Irish youth were looking for new spaces where there weren't set rituals about how to behave, spaces they could own and shape and dance to the music they loved as equals with their peers. So as some teenagers outrightly rejected the show band dancehall scene, others began to follow, and Ireland saw a boom in new beat clubs, as Pete Cummins remembers.
They were really important because this was the really new generation. There were ballrooms in Dublin where show bands would play, you know, and there were ballrooms where big bands would play, places like the Metropole in O'Connell Street and Cleary's Ballroom, and the old big bands would play there, you know, the kind of Joe Loss type bands. But when the beat clubs opened, it was like a whole different thing, you know. This was for young people who considered themselves cool, you know. And although, as I say, still there was no drink involved in any of these places. They were dry places. I mean, I'm not saying people didn't drink. I certainly wasn't really drinking at all in those days. But they were very important. People started to meet other people, you know, from outside of your district, you know. That's how you met people, you know. You'd meet people from all over the city. I mean, I know people still from those days, you know, who I met in those clubs.
Ireland in the 60s was just beginning to recover from, politically, from the Civil War, I suppose, and also from De Valera. The church, though, was still had a grip on the soft underbelly of the youth, certainly. And they got their knickers in a huge twist when beat clubs opened. Long hair seemed to freak them out as well, because we started to grow a hair long. It was just something you could do to indicate that you were in some way extremely hip. None of us really were, but we thought we were.
Musician and artist Tim Booth of experimental folk group Dr. Strangely Strange, who formed in Dublin.
And then I got asked to work on a club in Limerick, and I think it was called The Countdown, but it might have been The Cavalier, I'm not sure about that. It was in the basement of some kind of Georgian building, you know where the Georgian terraces are in Limerick, it was somewhere up there. And there was a guy that I'd met in Trinity called Roger Cheveley, who at this stage was working as a designer for one of the television stations in London. He'd been asked to do it, and he knew me. I think I'd left Trinity and I was working in Arcs Advertising. And we went down, and over a weekend, we psychedelicized and did stuff. I did a lot of murals, and we had specialized paint that Roger had, which changed its light. It changed its color as you change the light. It reflected in a weird way. And this was kind of unheard of in Ireland. So we put all this all over this club. And Peter Adler's band, Next in Line, and the Grannies Intentions were the opening acts. I can't remember who came on first, but Adler was good in, he was a showman. But the Grannies were doing original, quite a lot of original stuff. And Johnny Doohan had an intensity that was genuine, where Adler had an intensity in the same way that it wasn't real. Like, it was good, but it wasn't. It didn't ring true. There was a crack somewhere. But Johnny and the Grannies were just, it was the real thing, and it was Irish, and it was, you know, you would, and Cheevely, who was English, said, "Oh wow, they're a bit good, aren't they?" Wow.
Started playing first in Limerick, we had the Go-Go and the Cavalier, but we were so mad to play, we would play any place. And I remember playing in the Bora Boy Band Hut up here at the top of Edward Street in Limerick, and it wasn't the size of two rooms, and there was a potbelly stove inside in the middle of it. A cast iron belly stove. I can remember doing painted black, the stones thing. I can remember playing that in there. But we also played the old Red Cross Hall. And these halls, even though they were small, and they were our halls. They weren't opened up by the management of Go-Go or the management. These were our own halls, and it was different from going to the Jetland, out to the ballrooms. We started this. We got all music in here, so that was part of our goal as well. To have our own little places that we could have our people together and listening to the music that we wanted to play and they wanted to listen to.
But the rebellious youth of 60s Ireland were on a collision course with both the church and state. An article in the Irish Press from September 1966 documents how a Father Egan wanted parents to investigate these beat clubs as there were allegations of necking. The DJ was also apparently encouraging club members to join in a slimy, slippery slow dance and also told participants as they left, "Don't forget, be sexy."
It was a relatively innocent time in very many ways, but also young women were going on the pill. So there was actually quite a sexual revolution going on at the same time. So in a way, the church was right to be aware of it, but wrong to be so bothered by it. The clubs, they were pretty innocent. There was no alcohol unless you brought it in a hip flask or something. They were fairly innocent, really. There was a little, tiny bit of drug taking, but mostly soft drugs, very little of it. The guards didn't seem to be particularly bothered by the clubs. I never saw, in the Dublin clubs, I never saw anybody trying to close it down in any way, but I do know the church were bothered by it, and perhaps rightly so, because ideas were fertilising.
These clubs were important to our age group because we were bringing the music we liked into them, and we wanted to have our own bit of freedom in there as well. freedom, I mean by not like back in the cinema or pictures when we used to go, that you had the flashlight in your eye, or the minute you put your arm around a guy is down with the flashlight, or in, like the ballrooms, bright lights, and you thought you were in the middle of Willem Street, it was so bright there. These clubs that we had ourselves, they were torn down a light wise, and because it suited the music that was being played. And if you had a slow tune, and you were dancing with your partner, you had the freedom to hold her and dance the way that is probably, it's grand. It's all right. But it turned out that it wasn't all right by the religious people in the town and small minded people saying that, oh, they're down in this dens of iniquity and they're up to every, which was completely and utterly wrong. And the religious people saying, look, oh, we'll have to keep an eye on this wrongdoing going on in these places, and it'd be better if we took these places over ourselves and ran them and made sure they ran like we want them to be ran, rather than the people who go to them want them to be ran. So that's their input into shutting up the clubs around the town and opening them up themselves, and with them keeping an eye on it and also making the money out of it.
The Beat Clubs even came to the attention of the Dáil in 1966, with a Mr. Jerry Lestrange asking the then Minister for Justice if he was aware of alleged drug peddling in these clubs and when he intended to introduce legislation so that they could be subjected to the same controls as dance halls. Teenagers marched in both Dublin and Limerick to save their clubs, with 17-year-old student Tony Hines being quoted in the Irish press as saying, "Parents have a wrong impression of the clubs for the simple reason that they have never been inside." As the conflicts between youth and church and state were ongoing, Granny's Intentions were making their mark as one of the best beat groups in Ireland.
Following on from all the success of the beat group competitions, obviously, Grannies were the number one band in Limerick, so they would have been the headliners in the beat clubs, in the Go-Go Club and the Cavalier Club. And also, you would have had a few Dublin bands coming down to play with them. Seeing them in the Go-Go Club, there was no drink inside there, and the place was just, you know, just sweating, you could call it another way. It was just the heat, the excitement of the band that the band created on stage. And Johnny Doohan, songs that stand out in my mind, him singing, would have been Out of Time, a song composed by the Rolling Stones, but a big hit by Chris Farrell and the Thunderbirds. And he was unbelievable. He'd work himself into a frenzy, like Mick Jagger or Chris Farlow, or even some of when they did the Motown stuff, he would have been like some of the singers in the Temptations, or you know, Levi Stubbs at the Four Tops, or you know, when they were doing Reach Out, I'll Be There, or Stop in the Name of Love. And they created anthems, actually, like a song like Stop in the Name of Love. He'd put his hand up in the air and everybody would just shout out, "Stop in the name of love." They would just carry on the chorus of it, that he had it to perfection. And the band were very tight. They were well rehearsed, very tight band. And it was just, you know, you came away with great, you came away well satisfied with the entertainment that you got on the night. And nobody had a drink in the place, like, you know.
Despite their members being in school and having jobs, the Intentions, as they were still known, decided that if they were going to make it with the group, that they had to move to Dublin to concentrate fully on the band. Johnny Doohan remembers their first gig in Dublin's Go-Go Club.
The first night we played there, I think Pat Egan was there. I could be wrong now, but we actually went down really well with the crowd. There was a certain portion of the group, or the crowd, that looked at us as being culches, that up from the sticks, like, you know, and what were we doing? And I remember I nearly got taken out of the club that night, and two lads didn't like the tone of my voice or whatever. I asked a few people to stop talking, you know, listen to what we were doing, and I've come a cropper with that lots of times in my career. and they were going to chuck me into the Liffey, as they said, you know, but the bouncer spotted them and trying to get me out of the club.
When we moved to Dublin, the club goers wouldn't see intentions Limerick. Their reaction would be, oh, Jesus, a lot of cultures. So we said we'd mark it, we'd put something on this, a really kind of throw a bit of comical stuff to it. So we'd go on stage, and the first number, we'd play first few bars of Larry Cunningham's, who was a big showman head at the time. Last night I had a pleasant dream. I woke up with a smile, and we do the first few bars of that, and you could see the faces on the crowd. Oh, Jesus. After doing a couple of bars, we'd just hit the snare drum and go straight into James Brown. I feel good, and they just look in amazement. They said, Jesus, where are these cultures coming? We really changed their mind about us being cultures. That's the... That was the Larry Cunningham thing, yeah. I got you. Oh, I feel nice. A sugar and spice.
I feel nice. I actually only went away for the weekend, you know, according from my parents' point of view, and it just showed you how big a country Ireland was in those days, because communications was like so remote and Limerick was so far away from Dublin. The rest of the guys had quit their jobs and they'd done everything properly. I was the only one that packed a couple of Ganzies in a bag and a couple of clean pairs of socks and maybe a couple of changes of underwear, because I didn't want to look like I was going away forever. I was only going for the weekend, as was normal routine. And so it was, for all of us, a huge move, you know. Dublin was just another world, you know. This was the Mecca for us to go to. And when we went there, of course, we were living literally in that place in 31 Leeson Street. And actually, Mick Cooney had a woman living there at the time, a lodger or whatever. Actually, she went professional a little bit ahead of us, shall I put it like that? She was making her living, meeting men, several on the same night. And if it hadn't been for her, we probably would have starved. You know, she kept us in food and everything else. And that's the way it was in those days. It was just unbelievable, you know. And everything kind of fell apart in terms of where we were going to get the work and... Yeah, it was a nightmare. And we were all living in this grotty, awful, awful place. Cha and I think Johnny and maybe even Guido and myself, four of us were sleeping in a huge double bed, you know, top to tail. So all the excitement of groupies and all the rest of it didn't touch us for a long time.
The band changed their name to Granny's Intentions on the advice of their manager, Mick Cooney, and had some unusual ideas to get attention.
One of the reasons we cracked it was we were very energetic. We were doing kind of music that nobody else was doing in Dublin. And we also devised, it was coming up to the time of the flower power thing, you know. So I remember one night I decided it would be a great idea if we released a dove from the stage, you know, a symbol of peace and love. And with that in mind, we went out and we went to this... fellow who kept a pigeon loft and out in the Cabra or somewhere. He didn't quite have the white dove, you know, but he had one kind of greyish white, you know. So we took that, and we that night in the Scene Club, right at the height of the frenzy, because we'd play for maybe 2 hours or something and get the crowd really going, you know. I pulled out the bird and I said, "Now, peace," and whatever, and I let him fly off. And I thought he was going to come back, circle around, and we put him back into the box, you know. But instead of that, the crowd went absolutely ape and followed the bird down to the end, caught him, plucked off his head. It was almost like a coven or whatever you call them. And came back up and handed me the bird, you know. But it was that kind of madness that was going on at the stage. And it was in that club, particularly the Scene Club, that I'd say we made our name. You know, the place used to be stuffed, turning people away every time we played there. I remember one night, it got so hot and heavy, like, that I actually collapsed on the stage and had to be whisked off in to the local hospital.
I went to see them first in the Scene Club in Dublin, and they were absolutely brilliant. I really was knocked out with them, their energy, and they were very, very fresh, and they all seemed to have this look about them. They looked like the small faces. They had that kind of look about them, and they definitely were fresh, exciting, energetic. And the girls went completely wild for them. I had never seen anything like it in Dublin now. I mean, we'd seen a few things, but this was something new, you know. The women went completely mad for them, you know. But then we got friendly with them, and then actually a couple of guys from my band ended up in Granny's Intentions. That was John Ryan, the keyboard player, and Greg Donaghy, the drummer.
I remember the first time we played on the Late Late Show, Gay Byrne. Gay was very honest. He just came out and said, you know, this wouldn't be my cup of tea, you know, like, you know, these fellas look very strange, and, you know, they're called Granny's Intentions, like, you know, and that was quite shocking for the, and he thought that Ireland would be laughing there, you know, and they probably were at the time, you know, God knows.
Mick Coney, as I said, was the first manager, Dublin manager, and when we moved to Dunleary, a guy by the name of Brian Choate, who was an ex-member of a show band himself, and he had been all over Europe with the show band, and he wanted to take us over, so he became the manager then, and we had made ourselves as big as we would could in Dublin. And if we wanted a recording contract, we had to make a move to London. So, yeah, we moved to London, and we lived in a place called the Medicine Hotel in Sussex Gardens, just around the corner from Marble Arch. And we got a contract then with Decca. They had a new label out at the time, Deerham. They came and listened to us. They liked what they heard. They gave us a contract, so that's how we became signed up by Deerham.
Granny's Intentions moved to London and also toured Europe. The lineup of the original band changed, with Gary Moore joining, and an album called Honest Injun was released. The group eventually went their separate ways, even though they had secured a second record deal, but the legacy of what they achieved had a massive influence, as beat scene musician Brush Shields recalls.
If I was to look at it from my own point of view, I started two guys off, Philip and Gary Moore. And both of them are known all over the world. These guys came from the same place as the Grannies, you know what I mean? They came from the same flats, came eating off the same table, you know, eating little or no food at the same time. Same attitude. All the Grannies are still alive. Philip and Gary, like, went prematurely to the promised land. But they would be very, Gary and Phil were very much a part of the Granny story. So wherever they, Phil and Gary went to, they took a bit of the Grannies with them. You know, like, they're all part of the same. Or you talk about Phil talking to the boys and the Grannies one night, or Gary talking to them one night. That could have sent them to the next place that we're going. You know, that could have been inspired them to don't give up now, or keep this, or you're good at that, you're great at this. And somebody could have said something, which I'm sure they did, that inspired the lads to keep going. So anybody who's been in your company that went on to do very well, there's a very good chance that you might have, you've affected them in a positive way. And that's really the way it was. They got a part of the same little group. And the Grannies, Skid Row, Gary Moore and all, they're all in around Dublin and around what was happening. And knew the lads very well and hung out with them. Now, that's the way it was. We were part of a time where X amount of lads done very, very well and went worldwide. And that's all anybody could ask for, you know.
In 2014, Paul Tarpey, a senior lecturer in Limerick School of Art and Design, curated a project for EVA International. It celebrated the understated achievements of the 60s generation and juxtaposed it with contemporary youth, creating a new piece of music in the process.
In the study of culture, EVA, the International Biennial, had a theme called Agitationism. And it concentrated on just different forms of, I suppose, I wouldn't call it protest, but sort of statements based on social scenarios. And I was researching really interesting sort of small hidden histories, such as the Maoist bookshop on Nicholas Street, the influence of the go-go clubs, and generally the, I suppose, the beat people, the hippie people that were around from 66 to 73, and the fact that so many of the participants of that scene were actually working, were actually putting on gigs, were actually looking at spaces, running charity things around Limerick in their own quiet way. So I propose that we kind of do a history project that links the importance of these things and just shine a light on it, basically. So to that end, what we did was I talked to Chahar of Granny's Intentions, and he suggested that we use the Red Cross Hall, and there was great significance for that because about 1964, one of the first gigs that he ever put on as a young beat musician for his own crowd, away from the dancehall culture, to make it the youth for the youth space themselves, was in the Red Cross Hall in Cecil Street. So we decided to go back into that hall and create something that kind of illustrated his history. Part of it was workshop-led, because an important part of it, where we went to the Limerick Youth Services and we just had a round table with people talking about their experiences. And very quickly, it seemed that the experiences that Cha had when he was 16 and 15 and 16, they were so influential in different parts of the city. The contemporary youth had the same thing. So we took suggestions and, you know, decided to forge something new to make it an event. So what happened then, we got DJ Deviant on board, and Andy's one of the really high-end contemporary composers that has kind of looked at music from a kind of hip-hop beat-digging perspective. And to put the likes of him with the likes of Cha and the likes of musicians and the youth to see what would come up. And on the night, we put them beside Cha's band. So Cha and Guido, originally in Granny's Intentions, are still playing and sounding as great as ever after those years, and doing it for themselves and doing it in different spaces. So it was a great night in terms of a clash of kind of just a kind of wave of experience between everybody for a crowd.
Generations may pass and technologies change, but the urge for youths to be different remains the same.
I was invited along by Paul to the EVA project, and they had a group of 16-year-olds, 17, and we chatted openly about when I was 16 and the similarities between both of us, between myself being 16 and them now. It was practically exactly the same they feel, even now, with all our technology and the whole lot, they still feel that they want to do something different. It's too straight. There's no bins on the road for them, and they want to break out and do something and express themselves, which exactly what we wanted to do in when we were 16, you know.
Generational Resistance was presented and produced by Peter Curtin. The programme was a Lyric Feature Commission funded by the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland from the television licence fee.